Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. Are you a fan of scary movies? Were you first in line for The Conjuring last week? If you enjoy a little fright, you might love my next guest article called The Blip in New York Magazine. No screams, no gore. It's not a relative of the blob, but it's the idea that the American dream, starting with nothing and making your way into the middle class, could have just been an accident of history whose time has passed. The author of that article, New York Magazine staff writer Benjamin Wallace Wells, joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here. Fun topic for a summer Friday. Right?
I have to tell you, I started this article early this week, home, getting ready to go to sleep, and I get about halfway through, and I'm like, I'm just not going to read the rest of this. And then I was like, no, I need to. And so basically, I mean, we've been talking about social mobility all this week on the Brian Lehrer Show. And what you propose, or you introduce us to an economist in your article that says maybe we don't have a lot to do with this after all. What's his basic idea?
So the guy I write about in this piece is an economist at Northwestern named Bob Gordon. And Gordon is a very eminent economist in his 70s. He's been a prominent macroeconomist for a long time. And he, at the end of last summer, he started to give talks that ended up in a paper whose title is U.S. Economic Growth Over? And his basic argument has two parts. The first part is historical. And he says, if you look at all of human history, if you go back as far as we can, and you look at, how much did living standards improve year over year in countries all around the world, the period from 1870 to 1970 in the United States is completely exceptional. There's nothing like it. Mm. We had an escalation, for 100 years of living standards year to year, of GDP growth from year to year, that was, several times anything that anybody had done before. And he says the reason that we were able to do that was not just that we had, a well-structured capitalist machine, that we had a free society, that we had sort of the structural components to let us have good economic growth. It's that we had the second industrial revolution here. And he says, if you look at the growth that took place, not just in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s, but all the way through the 1950s and 1960s, really what you're doing is spooling out the two basic innovations of the second industrial revolution, one of which is electricity and the other is the internal combustion engine. So the internal combustion engine eventually gives you the car and then the airplane and then the interstate highway system. And he says you can see the gains from that whole class, those two whole classes of innovations through a century, and then they kind of peter out around 1970. And what we've been living in since 1970 is the third industrial revolution. It's the computer age. And his argument is the computer age just doesn't have as much juice as electricity and the internal combustion engine. And if you look at the productivity numbers, he's got a point. With the exception of this particular boom from 1996 to 2004, the whole period since 1972 has been pretty weak in terms of increasing productivity compared to the period in the past. So that's the first part of his argument.
Yeah. Well, what I find so fascinating is you're basically presenting this idea that it's not American exceptionalism, but that period was historical exceptionalism, and it cuts right at our national identity. If this isn't something that's part of Americanness and was instead a consequence of where we were in terms of technical innovation, that's really kind of shaking. So I want to actually bring in a quote from President Obama this week, because he also was talking about similar trends, but he was making the argument that there's something we can do about it. Here's President Obama speaking at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois this week.
If we're willing to take a few bold steps, if Washington will just shake off its complacency and set aside the kind of slash and burn partisanship that we've just seen for way too long, if we just make some common sense decisions, our economy will be stronger a year from now. It'll be stronger 5 years from now. It'll be stronger 10 years from now.
So there you have the president saying we just need to be bold, that it's gridlock that's holding us back.
Politics, right.
But Robert Gordon begs to differ?
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, what Gordon says about the current moment is we have a series of structural impediments to growing more. So if you – none of these are news, but what is fresh about Gordon's take is that he shows the way in which each of them mathematically depress growth. And so if you look at, the retirement of the baby boom, if you look at, the kind of plateauing of American educational achievement, the generation currently in its 20s will be the first generation in American history to be no more educated than its parents were. If you look at the inefficiency of healthcare, there are these sort of structural demographic reasons that we can say this is going to be a tough haul. And, you know, because of the sheer size of our population right now, and because compared to where we were at the beginning of the Second Industrial Revolution, and because of these structural problems or deficits that we're facing, Gordon says even if, you know, the computer age moving forward, even if artificial intelligence and robots, did everything that we hope, we would need the innovations of today to be 8 times as powerful as those of the Second Industrial Revolution to match the accelerating rate of growth that we had in the last century. Now, that's pretty astonishing to me.
I think one of the more interesting or the lighter scenes, funnier passages in your article is when you talk about Robert Gordon showing up at the TED conference and he just bombs because this is an audience that of tech futurists who just look to the future in that computer age and see nothing but possibility and opportunity. And they don't like to hear him, what he has to say.
Yeah, So Gordon schleps out there to Long Beach, and, he's 72 years old, but he's, an economics professor, and he's bothered by the flight, and they make him change his slides, and that annoys him. And he gives this presentation full of doom and gloom, and he puts up all these slides about, how grim life was before the Second Industrial Revolution, how much it improved in 100 years. And at the end of the talk, they ask how many people agree with him, and he gets like 10 hands out of an audience of hundreds. And then this other guy, Eric Brynjolfsson, who's another character in the piece, is a technologist at MIT, comes in and he says, economic growth isn't over. We've got robots to look forward to. And the audience goes nuts, And there are, I think I don't know that I buy 100% of Gordon's argument. I don't know that I'm quite as pessimistic as him. But one thing that is notable is Gordon's prediction is basically moving forward. It will no longer take one generation for Americans to double the standard of living of their parents. It will now take two. One thing that's notable is when you talk to the other economists who have done their best to project technology out into the future and have wrestled with these same themes, they are a bit more optimistic than Gordon, but there is nobody that I found whose main prediction is that we will see the kind of growth that we saw over the last 100 years. It's just the demographic challenges I talked about, the kind of scale of innovation we need is too grand. But there are a lot of kind of categories of innovation that are incredibly exciting and that people like Eric Brynjolfsson and the people at the TED conference can look at and dream on.
So one of the things that I thought was interesting was when you followed up about the argument, well, but we have robots. When you followed up, there wasn't a lot of information about what that meant in terms of jobs.
Yeah, I mean, this is with Brynjolfsson. You know, I called Brynjolfsson up after watching him talk in Long Beach at his office at MIT, and I said, what does that actually? Let's spool this out a little bit. You know, if we have all of these incredible breakthroughs that you say are kind of on the horizon, if you're an evangelist for the driverless car and the modern intelligent robot factory, what do human beings look like in that? You know, what does that economy shape actually resemble? And he said basically, for people at the very upper end and very lower end of the skill and income scale, they'll be fine. You know, we need both. Robots are very bad at both sort of people management, executive skills, what he calls non-physical, non-routine work. And they're very, and robots are also very bad at non-routine physical work, things like gardening. It turns out that, you know, because robots haven't evolved in a physical world for, you know, millennia the way that human beings are, even the smartest robots, if you take a fork and you rotate it 30 degrees, can't recognize it. The problem is that 65% of American jobs lie in what economists and technologists tend to call information processing jobs, you know. And these are things that robots, that machines were developed, you know, precisely to do. Brynjolfsson's great example is the tax preparation industry. Since we had TurboTax and H&R Block, their online tax preparation software has been developed, which is effectively a robotization of doing your taxes, of accountancy. The tax preparation industry has gotten much more efficient, and you know, the profits that those companies have been able to make have been huge, and a small number of people have made an enormous amount of money. But we've gutted the portion of jobs that are available for human accountants. And so I said to him, he gave me a couple of examples of places where humans and robots could work together. And I said to him, you know, how scalable is this? And he said, you know, well, that's the challenge we have. You know, there are not yet a lot of great examples of how we can kind of make up this deficit.
So I want to end on a bit of an optimistic note. You said that you weren't as pessimistic as Robert Gordon.
Yeah.
So when he says that we need innovations eight times as powerful as the Second Industrial Revolution, where is it that we have agency? I mean, what do you do to try to kickstart that kind of innovation?
Well, look, I'm a tremendous believer in our political system and our kind of evolving social organism. And if things really do start to plateau, most of the deficits that he is talking about are reversible. You know, if we're really, really worried about our demographic challenges, we can loosen our immigration policies. If we're really, really worried about, as I think we should be, about the fact that, you know, this generation of Americans is going to be no more educated than the ones that came before, then we can make serious maneuvers on student debt. We can figure out ways to finance higher education. None of these challenges seem unbreachable or impossible. And it's true that, you know, in the very current moment, in the second half of the Obama administration, it doesn't seem like politics is a great place to look for policy solutions. But in the scope of things that Gordon's talking about, and in the kind of, you know, just the grandness of his bleak vision of the future, I mean, there's a lot of time. And if things are as bad as he says, you know, there's a lot of time and a lot of power to kind of make those deficits up. But I think that the thing for me that I took away from this piece is just the backward gaze. You know, it's just how absolutely singular the experience of this country has been for, you know, 150 years in human history. And yeah, it's not crazy to think maybe that was built on particular circumstances, and maybe we won't be able to extend that out into the future for so much longer.
I've been speaking to Benjamin Wallace Wells, staff writer at New York Magazine, about his article in this week's issue called The Blip. It's a great piece. Thanks so much for joining us here on WNYC.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Up next, we're going to talk about three generations trying to live together. Katie Hafner joins me to talk about her Sandwich Generation memoir. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer.